Good morning, everyone. My name is Kyle. I am an alcoholic. I'll be your 10-minute speaker. First of all, I will say my sobriety date is July 10th, 2017. My sponsor is Doug. My home group is Young People's Alcoholics Anonymous in Visalia. I'm the secretary there. It's a privilege. Thank you, Anita, for asking me to share, you know, put me on the spot. I'll just go with the flow. You know, this program, it happened, you know, 11 months ago in this room. You know, I came up here. I was a resident at PAR. And, you know, I went in there with the mindset that, you know, I didn't want to change. I still wanted to do what I was going to do, you know. You know, I'm an adult. I'm going to do what I want. And I was doing it all for the wrong reasons, you know. And when I came here to this meeting, and at the end, you know, when we prayed out, something just overcame me, you know, and I saw my life flash before my eyes, all the, you know, misery I was causing, the damage I was doing, and, you know, living in that lifestyle, you know, robbing, stealing, cheating, lying, you know, and looking at all these faces and how happy people were and, you know, enjoying life, you know, it's, you know, God spoke to me and says, you really want that life, you don't want this. And ever since that moment, I've been doing the work, you know, I changed completely, you know, without my sponsor in my life and a few other key people in my life wouldn't be where it is now, you know, and I'm truly grateful for that and for these rooms. A little back history, you know, my family, alcohol was always accepted, you know, my grandpa is an alcoholic, my dad was an alcoholic, you know, drinking was just the norm, you know, when I was growing up, it wasn't unusual for me to be 8, 9 years old with a beer in my hand, drinking at family functions and going on trips, and, you know, I grew up in a small town, Dinuba, and lived out in the country, and I was taking my stepdad's beers and throw them in my backpack and go shoot my BB gun out in the fields drinking, you know. I didn't really think drinking was a problem, you know. It was just acceptable. And, you know, it progressed after that. In high school, I was known as, you know, the partier, drinking, you know, smoking weed and whatever else I can get my hands on, you know. And, you know, I thought I had the life. You know, my mom, you know, she was struggling. She had a hysterectomy and got addicted to pills. And, you know, she was going on a downward spiral. So, you know, from there, I started becoming a great manipulator at a young age. You know, getting her car at 15 and driving around with my buddy. And getting high and drinking, and, you know, we had our little store that would sell to us. And, you know, it was just the norm, you know. I wrecked her car, and it just was nothing after that, you know. I was started working when I was young, and then, you know, I was drinking before going to work. I got another job and was drinking there, you know. And, you know, luckily I never got a DUI or got in an accident. You know, I was one of those lucky ones. But, you know, once I lost my job and was on unemployment for a few years and I had my son, it was kind of a, you know, a blessing that I get to watch my son grow up. But, you know, at that time, you know, I was still drinking. I wasn't really there for him. And, you know, I was drinking every day. And it just progressed after that. I decided to go back to school and was drinking. And then, you know, I got mixed up in another drug, you know, and that's when my life really started to spiral out of control. And, you know, it didn't take long for me to, you know, drop out of school and almost lose everything that I had. You know, I end up going to prison, you know, and I man up to that. I did my time and I got out, and I thought things were going to change. But, you know, being in that environment, it wasn't, you know, when I got out, it was like if I was missing something, I had to catch up on that time, that missed time that I had, you know. And so I had to go out, and I went out full force and drinking and partying and doing the same things that led me to going to prison the first time. You know, I was doing it all over again, and end up giving a dirty, and my parole officer at that time, he gave me to a program, Turning Point in Visalia, and I did good, but I was just faking it to make it. You know, I didn't want to do the steps, I didn't want to go to meetings, I didn't want to sponsor, you know, I could do this on my own, you know, I got this, I can do it on my own. Did good for about, you know, graduated that 3 months program and did good for like a month and a half. And my parole officer at the time, he lowered my supervision to every other month. And then my birthday was coming up. So I'm like, oh, so I can go out and party and do whatever I want, you know, and I got enough time to get clean and do that? No. There's no controlling, you know. And end up going to par, and you know, that's where it happened to me. And I've been, you know, I started to do things different. I, you know, this one person said, you know, try something you never done before, you know, do something for the first time and out of your comfort zone. And that's what I learned, you know, do something unusual, do something that, you know, it makes you uncomfortable, you know, coming up here and speaking in front of everyone, you know. But I like kind of being on the spot and just going with the flow and speaking, you know. I don't have a trouble with that. My wife says I'm too open. I'm like, I'll tell everybody, you know, about my past and where I've been, you know. And you know, the changes have come to me, you know, very fast. You know, I've been truly blessed in my life, you know, meeting wonderful people and given opportunities, you know. And when I finished this last program, this last round, you know, I started finding myself in a dark spot again, you know, getting down on myself. Here I am at home again and not providing, not being the what a man should be, you know, a provider for his family. You know, I'm just at home being a bum again. And luckily, you know, God answered my prayer and I got a job. And I've been working this job for about 7 months now. I enjoy it. You know, I'm in charge of my own route now. I got my own truck, you know, and things are going good, you know. And a big part that made me want to change was, you know, my father, you know. When I was in the first program, I lost my father due to this disease, you know. And it's going to be about 2 years now since he passed away. And, you know, I think about him and ask myself, like, well, I wish he would have got helped. I wish he, you know, he would have put his pride aside and came to these doors, you know, and got the help he needed. You know, he was only 53 years old, and, you know, my son doesn't get to grow up with his grandfather. And that was a big thing for me, was being with my grandparents and being outdoors, going fishing and off-roading, you know. But, you know, luckily I get to pass that on to my son, his memories and everything. You know, and like lately, you know, as I'm coming up to my year, you know, in July I'll have a year. And when I work, you know, I'm driving in a truck and I work down in Bakersfield. So, you know, I'm by myself and I have a lot of time to, you know, to reflect on my life and everything. It's just like, wow, I can't believe, you know, how far I've come in such a little bit amount of time, you know. And the things I was doing, you know, how should I deserve all this? You know, I was a thief out there. I was robbing people. I was breaking into houses. I was, you know, you're all around dirt bag, you know. And, you know, I don't really beat myself up too much about it now, you know, because, you know, that was my past. You know, you got to move forward. We all go through lessons in life. But, you know, it was just, you know, I was a sick person, you know, in my disease, you know. And, you know, I owed up to it. I made amends to those I could, you know, and I'm making a living amends now, you know. And that's what it's about, you know, by making life choices and changing it, you know. And people at work, they're like, oh my God, I can't believe you went to prison. Or when I meet other people, like, you don't seem the kind of person that would do that. And I was like, you know, well, I'm not. You know, it was just, I had a clouded mind, you know, and I was a scandalous ass person. You know, but, you know, I wouldn't change my past. It wouldn't have gave me the opportunity to have this success in my life. It wouldn't have gave me the outlook that I have on life now, you know, being that way, you know, from almost losing everything, being homeless on the streets, you know, not having my wife and my son at home, you know. And I'm so thankful for her for, you know, giving me the tough love and locking me out of the house, telling me I'm not going to come home, and making me truly realize what it is that I wanted in life, you know. And, you know, I'm not saying, you know, I still have problems in my life. I still got character defects, you know, but I'm able to identify them now, and I'm able to call up my sponsor and talk to them, or key people in my life to, you know, pick up that phone and talk out what's going on with me, you know, even if it's just a minor problem or, you know, something that doesn't seem that big of a deal, but, you know, it's a, how they say, a Cadillac problem for me, you know. It's, I think the most thing I complain about is my Jeep. Yeah, I'm always, oh, the Jeep's broken, this and that, but I got a truck that's perfectly fine, you know. I got another vehicle, you know, like, here I am complaining about one vehicle, and I got three vehicles, you know. There's no, what are you complaining about? You know, I got lots to truly be thankful for, you know. You know, my relationship now is good. We're, you know, building it back up, you know. You know, we still have our problems, but, you know, we're able to talk it out and get through it. You know, that's the main thing, you know. I used to be a professional masonry, I would like to think, you know, because I used to build up walls and just keep myself locked up inside my own prison, you know. But now it's like I'm able to talk out my problems. I don't keep things bottled up anymore. And, you know, that's a key thing, you know, talk about issues and what's going on with you. You know, just in this short amount of time, you know, I just seen the change dramatically in my life, and it's just amazing. You know, I met, can look around, I see faces that I recognize. You know, at first I didn't want to go to meetings. Like, I don't know nobody. I don't know what to talk about. What, you know, I'm not going to relate with anybody, but, you know, giving it some time, you know, now I know faces, I know people, and, you know, last weekend I got to go to Pine Flat for a little retreat for, you know, our young people meeting that we were going, and it was awesome, you know. I got to enjoy fun, I got to save people from rattlesnakes. I'm all catching rattlesnakes in my flip-flops and shorts and getting rid of them, and everyone's all excited, you know. And it was awesome, you know, I got to go out, you know. It's just, I get to enjoy life now, you know, and it doesn't mean I have to, you know, drink a beer or get faded to enjoy life or think I'm having fun, you know. And going to work, I don't have to, my boss doesn't have to worry about me coming in hungover and wrecking his truck, you know, on the job, or if I'm going to call out sick or something, you know. And it feels good, you know, to be a valued employee. And, you know, I always strive for that, you know, father figure approval. You know, I never really got it from my dad because he was just a drunk. And so, like, when my boss pulled me to the side and said, you know, you're doing great, you know, you got your own truck now, you're in charge of your own route, keep it up, you're the man. And it's just like, yes, you know, that approval. You know, it's just by these rooms and the grace of God that I am where I'm at today, you know, and I am truly thankful for that. And with that, I'll keep coming back.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Anita, and I'm an alcoholic. I am very grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. God, I love the way everybody just cleans up and shows up and everybody works and just getting it done, you know. I didn't know how to do any of this when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe today that I have recovered from a hopeless or a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. When I got here, my mind was so cluttered, and I had a lot of hate, a lot of anger. I had everybody in the world to blame, even you, and I didn't even know you. I was very angry that I had to go into a treatment program. I'm going to back up. I'm going to talk a little bit about where I came from. Get a little comfortable here. Some of the stuff I was just teasing, because I never know what's going to come out of my mouth. I pray about it in the morning. I prayed about it before I came up here, and just asked my Creator to allow me to send a clear message about Alcoholics Anonymous and how I have recovered from the condition that I was in. And if I can remember what the condition was. My mouth somehow gets really dry up here. I think it's because I do get nervous, but nobody would know that if I didn't say it. So act like you didn't hear that. You know, when I was, I grew up on two different reservations, and one was right here at the Tule River Indian Reservation. It was my mom's reservation. I have a lot of family and friends up there. The other reservation is my dad's, which is the Santa Rosa Rancheria in Lemoore, California. And both, when I was growing up, were both poverty, a lot of alcohol. There was a lot of death and a lot of suicide. I remember my dad's best friend still laying out in the middle of his front yard over a bunch of wood. He had just shot himself when we got there. Nobody had been there. I was about maybe 4 or 5 years old when I seen that. I seen my first shooting at the age of 6 years old at a rodeo that they had San Juan's Day. The guy got shot 6 times, and I'm not too far from where the shooting had happened. So this kind of stuff was things that had happened before I ever touched alcohol. This type of behavior, being left and not knowing where the adults were, being left alone with kids. There were many predators around growing up in my household. And I, you know, growing up, I didn't think that there was a God. I didn't think that when I first started listening or having to go to church, I didn't really believe that what they were telling me was true. I didn't really understand it, but there was nothing about the life that I was, that I had been born into, that was any type of a decency or a happiness, because there wasn't a lot of, there wasn't a lot of happiness. The only time there was probably cheer was probably during the time 20 minutes after the party started. People were pretty happy, and then towards the drinking, you start seeing the fear. You know, as a kid, I was afraid, because next thing you know, they're going to start fighting. And then everybody leaves, and then nobody comes back, and the house would be a mess. And so that's what I was introduced to. You know, I didn't have much of a chance. I know I was born in the breeding grounds of alcoholics and addicts. I really know that today. It's still going on today. I still live on the reservation. I live right across the street from a lot of stuff that happens, and I see a lot of things happen still. I know of a lot of tribal members who have either shot themselves or tried to shoot themselves and lived to tell it. And, you know, and it just seemed like that was just common. It was just going to be the way life was, you know, and I had no explanation. I mean, there was nobody that was teaching me that this was the wrong way to live. They're just telling me to go to church, go to school, do this, do that. But there was never really any guidance growing up. And so when I say that, by the time when I was just a little girl, I didn't know I was a girl. I thought I was a boy. I thought I was my brother's brother, and I never knew that. And I always felt odd. I always felt weird. It wasn't until I was in kindergarten, when they taught me how to use the bathroom, that I realized that I was a little girl. And this didn't come out until my fourth step. None of this had come out until my fourth step, because it was stuff that I just didn't talk about, you know. And it wasn't something that I was embarrassed about. It was just something I put away. I've accepted I'm a girl. But it began to come out as I started to get sober. And so what ended up happening was my first drink, and it was here up in Success at the lake. I was about 8 years old, and my dad, and he'd buy some wine, and would stop at this little store, and the winos that lived up on the reservation, who were all my uncles, they were my mom's uncles, they were my great uncles, and they talked real rough, and they were beat up, and they were ugly. I mean, as an 8-year-old kid, I'm scared of these men, not because they would hurt me physically, but because the way they talked and how beat up they were, and their skin was really bad, and they were dirty. And but they were, one of them was my dad's brother. And it was his half brother. Anyway, we get up to the lake, and it's really cold. It's really cold, and I'm freezing, and I can't get out of the truck. And his brother, who was my Uncle Bob, said, "Why don't you let her have a little shot of this, Tone?" And my dad's name is Tony. They called him Tone. And so my dad let me have this little shot, this little cap of wine. And man, I loved it. I loved what it did to my ears. I love the way I wanted to hang out with the winos by the fire. I tell you, the next time we picked them up, I was no longer afraid of them. I look forward to seeing them again. And this continued throughout that time and during that winter. But, you know, it ended up where when it started to warm up, I was trying to act like it was cold when it wasn't. And none of the winos showed up. None of the winos showed up from the orange groves, because I would park there and wait for them to come out. And I asked my dad, where were they? And he said, they probably all went back up towards the reservation because it's warming up. So now I'm trying to think, how am I going to get that drink? You know? And I'm 8 years old. So I'm sitting there in the truck trying to act like I'm cold, and I'm shivering, you know? So my dad tells me to go ahead and stay in there. And so I waited. So when he walked down, he told me where he was going to be. He said, just wait here. I'll be back for you. By the time he had came back, I was already had drank some of that wine, and I was out. You know, and that's how my mom found out that I was drinking a little wine here and there, because my dad had to tell her that when he took me fishing, they'd let me have a little bit. You know, and then I hadn't drank again until I was about 10 years old. All through my life, I had been living off and on the reservation, on two different reservations, since I was probably 2 years old, and I know this through pictures. I see pictures that my grandmother had, my dad's mother, her name was Rose, and I called her Grandma Rosie, and Grandma Rosie loved me. She was the one who would take me away from all this chaos and the pain that I was going through, and take me home, and I'd live with her. And she was the grandma that would get up and cook. She was the grandma that would fix the bed. She was the grandma who I could sit there and watch her make her basket weaving. She'd take me up to the mountains, and I'd help her pick her roots for these baskets and some of her medicines. And I had a really good time. And she had I had an uncle that lived with her. His name was Clute. And he was cranky, but I was never afraid of him because he never hurt me. And he never bawled me out, and he never spanked me. So when you try to act like, when he was irritated and probably wanted to be alone in the living room watching TV, he'd try to act cranky, and I'd just still sit there, and then I'd look over, and I could see him smiling at me. You know, and so my grandmother off and on raised me back and forth. And the reason for it is I was so terrified of a grandmother, my mom's mom. And I'm not saying anything that my mom doesn't know. When they say that this is a family recovery, that our family recovers, we recovered. It's something that happened. I went to, when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I could tell you my whole drunk log, and you probably relate to it. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about that. But my so this grandmother that was mean to me, I never knew why. I never knew why. And it was painful for me. It was very painful for me, because I'm the kid that can't go out and skate on the skating rink, downtown Porterville skating rink. I couldn't go to the Porterville Plunge up there at the park. I forget what park. I think it's Murray Park. But I couldn't park. I couldn't do these things. And all the other kids, my siblings, were enjoying themselves. And I couldn't. I could never do that. My self-esteem was so low, you know. And it wasn't when I let me say this. It wasn't sexual abuse that my grandmother was doing. It was a mental, physical abuse. It was a mental, physical abuse, and I never, ever knew why. And I was terrified of her. And I didn't like the way the family lived while I lived here in Porterville, because, again, there was more drinking here. When I lived in Lemoore, I was taken care of by this grandmother, and I was treated really well by my uncles. My dad's brothers they were all really good to me, and I was always, and they were huge men. They were big cowboys, and I was always protected, and they always took me around with them, and I always rode horses, and I got to do some really fun things. I got to go to rodeos, and they got me into riding bulls and whatnot, and they thought it was the coolest thing, you know. And, I remember as a kid, my mom and dad would be ready to go back to Porterville if we were visiting in Lemoore, and I'd take off with other kids, and I would not come back because I knew that if I came back, they were going to take me back with them to Porterville. And so if I stayed long enough, they'd have to leave, and I got to stay. And I'd done that for a while, and then one time my dad, I stayed out, and I didn't come back, and my mom and them ended up leaving, and my dad stayed. And he waited for me to show up, and then he took me back to brought me back to Porterville. And I remember trying to think of things. How can I do this? How can I not ever come back to Porterville? I was terrified of Porterville. I was terrified of the Tule Indian Reservation. I was afraid of the dark. And when I was drinking, I know I said I started off when I was about 8 years old, and I liked it. I liked it when I was 10 years old. I liked it when I was 13 years old. I liked it when I was 16 years old. And after that, there was no more fun. You know, when I talk about my drinking fun, it was when I was a kid. It was when I was a kid. I was escaping things. I was hanging out. I was doing what I wanted. And I was having a good time. But as my disease progressed, into my adulthood, I was already an alcoholic. You know, I share this. My dad, I don't believe, was an alcoholic. I think he was like what it talks about in the big book, a certain type of hard drinker. Looked like us, resembled us. But my dad could stop. If something had happened, he got a job, he could stop, and he wouldn't drink for months. And or for whatever reason, whether he was drinking too much, he can decide he's not going to drink, and he wouldn't drink for months. And I never knew how to do that, because by the time I started to, I didn't know I had an alcohol problem, but I knew that I couldn't stop, and I didn't know what to call it, because I've never ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was never introduced to it, and nobody ever said, you drink too much. What I was told is all the crazy stuff that I was doing during my drinking as it progressed. Like I said, when I was a kid, I was having fun because I can jump right back up and do things. I can go out and play baseball. I can go out and softball. I can go out and go to a rodeo. I can go out and do right after drinking. But as it started to take me, I was no longer showing up. There was things I was missing. I was thinking about when I was about 13 years old. I thought a lot of my uncles, all of them. I loved every one of them. These were my dad's brothers, and I thought big of my dad. I thought that my dad was it. I just never was afraid. If my dad was there, he could fix anything. And a lot of people called on my dad. If there was something, if a tree was falling on your house or was about to, they'd call him, and he'd come and make it fall the other way, and he'd clean it all up, you know, and they'd pay him. If your house was sliding or slipping, it was old, he could come and fix the foundation. If your car broke down, he could fix it. So, and he always made some really good decisions, you know. I mean, he seemed like he was I idled my dad, as well as my uncles, because they did a lot of horseback riding, and they did a lot of, they were just good men to me, you know. And like I said, they never hurt me, they never terrified me, they never treated me wrong. And they would always hold me. I could sit on their lap since I was a little girl, sit on their lap. They'd tell me how beautiful my eyes were, you know, or they'd tell me how beautiful I was going to be. They'd tell me things like this. And even at that age, I didn't really believe them because I already had it installed that I was ugly. Because I was told I was ugly, because I was told not to look at my grandmother with my ugly eyes. My hair would be pulled or I'd be slapped, you know. And so the best that I can do was play real hard, because I was looking for that acceptance. And I'd get it from my uncles. I would. If I would get on a horse that was so rank and ride it and be able to at least green break it where other people were able to finish the job, I'd get pat on the backs for that. If I rode in a rodeo and I rode all the way, I'd get pat on the backs, even just for getting on, you know. And I'd be terrified, but I'd do these things because I wanted their approval, you know. Well, when I was 13 years old, the uncle that I lived with, the uncle that helped raise me with my grandmother, who I loved dearly, had shot and killed my dad's other brother. And this was the uncle that took me to the rodeos, who always I felt so protected by. And it was a devastating time for my family. And I remember thinking that my dad was going to pull us all through this. I just knew he would. And I remember when I came home that afternoon, my dad is laying on a bed. And there's a bottle of whiskey on the side of him. And he kind of wakes up. And I remember he's crying and he asked my mom if it was true. And my mom tells him, yes, hon, it is. And he says, my brother killed my brother. And drank himself right back into that passed out stage. And that's how I learned how to deal with pain. That's how I learned how to deal with the things that were going on. We didn't talk about how my grandmother was treating me. They sent me away. That's how they dealt with it. They thought they were doing the best they could, you know. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing, because I'm so grateful for that grandmother who took care of me. I loved her dearly. And as now I'm about 13, 14 years old, and I'm getting into some real trouble. I'm not wanting to go to school. All I want to do is drink, and I want to hang out and party and do these things. And so I'm doing it. And as I'm doing it, I ended up having two kids during my drinking, during that drinking stages. And I didn't treat them right. I didn't even know how to be a mother to them. As I continued drinking, you know, I remember thinking that they'd be better off if they just were with my mom, you know, because I really, and let me back up a little bit, because it wasn't that I didn't love them in the beginning. I forgot about that. I forgot about when I gave birth to them, how much I loved them, and I wanted everything for them. I wanted to be a mother. I didn't know how, but I loved them, and I remember feeling that sense. But through my drinking and all the behavior, I'm being told what an ugly person I am. And I'm not saying this is not, they were saying it worse than that. I'm being cussed at. I'm being yelled at. I'm being slapped for some of the things because I'm leaving these kids everywhere. Nobody knows where they're at. I mean, I'd have a babysitter and I'd have to, I was literally, I'd come to and I'd have to go look for my kids because I don't know where I left them last. I'd show up at a babysitter's house and they'd say, oh no, you didn't bring them here. And now I'm like really afraid because I don't know where I left them. Now I got to go find them at which babysitter I'm going to go check next, you know. And this was just continuing. I remember, there was things, a lot of my drinking I never talked about. I mean, there was always fighting, there was always violence in my drinking. I remember I would, before, I don't know when the blackout started, but I didn't know that's what was going on with me. I mean, I'm leaving my kids everywhere and I don't know where they're at, but I don't know that that's a blackout. I never heard what it was called. I remember I come home, and I'm hanging out with some violent people. I'm hanging out with people who aren't afraid to cut you. They're not afraid to stab you. They're not afraid of these things, at least, because they're doing it to me, so apparently they're not afraid. And I'm thinking to myself, why am I here? Why am I hanging out with these people? This is not me. This is not me, and because deep down I'm a good person. I mean, I thought I was. But then I can remember things that the violence, that the way I would feel towards people, I'm not that great of a person that I thought I was or who I think I am. You know, I was, and for some reason I'd be driving somewhere and I'd come to in the middle of the road. You know, I'd be driving and I'm thinking, where am I at? Where am I going? And I'd have no clue. One time I came to, I'm coming down, I believe it was in Sycamore, California, and I'm drinking with this group of people. They were all natives. But this lady is known for violence that's riding on the side of me. And I don't know how I ended up with these people, but they're in my car. And I'm getting stabbed at the same time. And she's hitting me with a, stabbing me with a screwdriver. And I'm getting hit all over in the arm as I'm blocking. And, you know, these were just some of the terrifying things that I would wake up to or come to in the middle of a blackout. Waking up in all the fields. I mean, I've woke up in many fields around my home, in that area, you know, a few miles away from the reservation. And I'd clean myself off the best I could with my own spit and just try to comb my hair with my fingers and try to walk as straight as I could to get back home. And I'm barefooted, you know, I'm barefooted a lot at this point. And I've had jobs. I had the same job. We have a casino, and back then it was just a bingo hall. And they used to hire us all the time. And you can get fired and get hired back in 3 months, and that was kind of my routine. And they were I was just a nuisance, you know. Now I'm getting cops called on me for drunk in public. The bars that I used to party on, there was 4 bars. One of them I never went into because it was a Mexican bar, and I didn't speak English. I mean, I didn't speak Spanish. So I don't speak English either. But so I never went in there. I didn't start going into that bar until I was kicked out of the other bars. Now I'm going in there. I think I was trying to speak Spanish. So that, if I could only have a recording of that, you know. But this is just my life, and it's going on and on and on. And these blackouts, you know, they were just getting worse and worse, but I didn't know that's what they were. I didn't know what a blackout was. And there was a lot of blackouts that I come to that I never would talk about. I would never tell about. And I remember passing out, and I'm underneath my bed. And again, like I said, the violence was real. My mother had already taken my kids away from me because of the violence. And I'm underneath my bed, and I'm way up in the corner. So there's the wall behind me, and there's the wall on the side of me, and there's nothing over here. But I'm too afraid to feel this way. And I'm just thinking, my God, somebody buried me alive, because on top I can feel the wood from the the box spring. So I'm really thinking somebody buried me somewhere. And and I want to back up a little bit. The reason why I felt that is because I'm being beat up places, and I'm being dropped off and left places. So that's what I'm thinking at this point. And then now I'm just stuck in this small little spot, and I'm too afraid to reach over. And then finally, I get the courage to start reaching. And you know what I start feeling is this little round steel thing. I'm not making it out, but I'm feeling it. And as I'm touching it, it's attached to something. And as I'm feeling it, it's cold and it's hard. As I'm going, and now I'm just kind of getting kind of brave here. So now I'm kind of going all the way around, and then it dawns on me, I'm underneath my bed. I'm not buried alive. I'm underneath my bed. I did not tell anybody about that one, you know. I have a lot of under the bed stories. I really do. I don't know, for some reason that's where I ended up. One time I was under the bed, and wake up from a drunk, and I can't see much. It's kind of like coming daylight, but it's not daylight yet, and there's not a lot of light underneath that bed. But I know I'm underneath the bed. That was the good thing. The bad thing was there was a snake right kind of on the side of me, and I'm watching it, and I'm just keep thinking the snake will leave if I just stay still. And it's pretty scary, and that's what I'm seeing. And I'm watching it, and I'm staying still, and it was kind of like a standoff, and the snake wouldn't leave, and I'm just sitting there. I mean, I'm just laying there stiff, and that's what I was told. If you ever come across a rattlesnake, just kind of stiff. And I don't know if that's a true story, but or if that's a real thing, but I stayed stiff, and so did the snake. Well, it turned out that as it got lighter in the room, and I could start seeing the snake, I realized it didn't. The tongue was like peeled off or chewed off or something, it dawned on me it was a stupid rubber snake that I was terrified of, you know, underneath this bed. And I tell you, it was, and those were just the, this was I'm 18, 19 years old, going through this fear, you know, and my neighbors are finding me and giving me wine because I'm so bad, I'm shaking. And I cry to them because I don't know what's going on with my life. I don't. I have no idea what's going on with my life. And now I'm starting to hear more about my blackouts. Some of the stupid stuff that I'm doing in these blackouts from some of my friends who, people that I partied with for, you know, since I was 13 years old, who they don't even want to be around me. They don't want to party with me no more because I'm doing stupid things like going into the bar and fighting or taking off with your car and leaving you somewhere. You know, I'm doing those tragic things or passing out somewhere with or stealing from you, you know, and I don't remember any of it. I don't. But it started to make sense why I started to think why that what they're telling me must be true, because I don't remember going home. I don't remember how I got there. So I'm kind of putting two and two together and you know, it dawned on me that I know what it is. I got a brain tumor and I'm going to die soon. You know, and that was my diagnosis. I just said I'm going to die soon. So this kind of gave me a reason to continue my drinking, you know. And finally, my mom and dad finally had enough of my drinking, and they told me I was going to go into a treatment center. And they sent me up to a treatment center up here in Tule River Reservation. It's called TRAP. I mean, I know you guys heard of them. Some of you have, because they used to come to meetings here, and it was my very first meeting I came to was here in Springville, California. And, you know, I didn't go there because I wanted recovery. In fact, I drank the night before I had to go into treatment. And the reason why I chose to drink that night is I knew I'd go into a blackout and I'd take off for 7 days. Nobody would find me or hear about me, and I'd lose that bed forever. And, you know, but it didn't happen that way. What happened was, is I went out to go get drunk and get into a blackout and be gone for 7 days. And you know what happened? I went into my friend's house and I drank there many times, and we got drunk together many times. And what ended up happening was, is all I did was get full, and I couldn't get drunk. And I remember I looked at the clock, and it had just turned 10 o'clock, and I said, I'm going home. And I went home, and I went into that treatment the next morning, and it was on a Wednesday. It was March 8th, and you know, I ended up staying sober. I didn't go in to stay sober. I ended up staying sober, and the way that happened was, is I found a sponsor. I kept coming to meetings, and I was doing what everybody told me to do, and I just didn't drink. But I was hearing a lot of little stories. I remember there's a fellow sitting in the room right now who described his first blackout, and I heard it in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't realize that it dawned on me. That's what those were. I didn't have a brain tumor. It was a blackout. And I was excited that I'm not going to die, you know. But it still didn't give me the desire to stop drinking. I had a desire to continue my drinking. I was only buying time. When I came into that treatment program, it was only going to buy me time, get my mom off my back, get my dad off my back. But I kept coming back, and I kept coming to the meetings. And I was going to this meeting down at PAR, the Women's PAR Center, and I hated it. I didn't like being around women. I didn't like being around men. I didn't like being around me. This meeting that we would go to, you know, and I didn't like it. And but I had no choice. You know, I just kept doing what I was told and go to meetings. They'd wake me up in the morning and tell me I had to cook breakfast, so I put out cereal, you know. I didn't take order too well. I really didn't. I wasn't ready for this. I didn't feel I wanted to do what you people were asking me to do. When I say you people, it was listening to you in meetings. That just wasn't true. How do I have to? Why do I have to give up my old friends? Why do I have to give up my old playgrounds? You know, you didn't grow up where I grew up. I have no other friends. I'm in a small community. This is my community. This is my family. I ain't giving that up. You know, and so I there was things that I just didn't. I wasn't wanting to give up. I felt I can prove you guys wrong. You know, and you know, One of the first, I remember getting one of my first resentments through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you guys, there was a few of you who kept telling me, hey, you need to read that story, join the tribe. It's in the third edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Join the tribe, join the tribe. And I'll tell you, I was really mad when I read that. I didn't read it all the way, by the way. All I had to read was it said it was an American Indian and this guy's from Canada. How is he an American Indian? I figured you guys out real quick. I did. I said, these guys are full of it. And anyway, and then I thought it was kind of awful that I thought you guys were making fun of him because of the broken language that was in there. But you know how many people told me when I was out there drinking and using, how many of our friends that weren't native would sometimes not understand what we were talking about? Because we had our own broken language. Our sentences were always short and we knew what we were talking about. And, you know, somebody would mention two things and we'd all be laughing and everybody's like, what are they laughing about over there, you know? So I was upset about that. But you know what happened? After I left here, I left and I had a sponsor. I remember her telling me I had to go up and I have to go visit my grandmother. You know, just go and try. Just go and knock on the door and go visit her. This is the grandmother who was verbally and physically abusive to me. And so I did, but I always got that same cold shoulder. And I would still get it all the way until I was... You know, until she passed, still get that same cold shoulder. She wanted nothing to do with me. But I still try because that's what I was told to do. And I show up. And I show up smiling. You know, and then I finally said, you know what? I remember calling my sponsor at the time. I said, I am not going to do this no more. I'm not going to do it. She wants nothing to do with me. And then she said, it's okay. You don't have to no more. You know now. You tried. And I didn't realize that's what I was doing. But it made sense right there. I gave it my best to try to form that relationship. And, you know, and it didn't happen. And so now I'm back in Lemoore, you know, and I remember I was still working with my sponsor up here in Springville. And I remember she told me something. She said, you're going to have to find a sponsor closer to home. Because I knew I was about ready to deal with the meat of the abuse, the pain, the things that I have created, the things that I have done. The things that were done to me. And I'm going to tell you, I'm so grateful because that sponsor who I found second is sitting in this room as well. These sponsors are both sitting in this room today. And I'm very grateful for that because I know I can't lie about my recovery, you know. I'll tell you, so what ended up happening was now I'm getting into all my grosser the grosser things that I have done through my drinking, and that sweet grandma that took care of me, my grandmother Rose, I adored her. She was beautiful, but you know, through all that drinking, I borrowed her car time and time again. She didn't have much. This grandmother would work seasonal. She would work seasonal and save her money and pay her bills throughout when the season wasn't going because she was a grape picker. She was an orange picker. And when there wasn't those seasons, we were up in the mountains getting her materials. And she was making baskets and she'd sell her baskets and she made good money back then. There was this thing called saltgrass that probably nobody in here knows about, but probably two of you. And it's a powder from my reservation in Lemoore, and you pick it and you beat it and it turns into a powder. And other tribes, I'm not kidding you, they go nuts over this stuff. It's sour and they love it and they pay money for it. And my grandma would do that too during the summer, and I'd go out and help her pick. I was always with her. And turns out that through my drinking, though, I become abusive, you know, mentally abusive towards this grandmother. I'm taking all my parties to her house now. I'm eating up all her food. I'm using up all her laundry. I'm keeping her up late at night. I'm listening to music. She can't get rid of me, you know. And then I'm begging her to borrow $10. I'm telling her, Graham, let me borrow $10 and I'll mow your lawn in the morning. I'll wash your car. I'll do all these things, you know. And she'd loan it to me. She'd get, but it was to get rid of me. you know, and I'd take off, and I'd never get that lawn finished. I'd never wash that car. Then I'd come back and borrow her car, and she'd tell me no, and I'd stay there until she gave it to me. She didn't give it to me because she loved me. She gave it to me because I was a nuisance. She needed to get me out of her hair. And then I'd bring that car back, and it'd be all nasty, dirty, throw up sometimes. You know, no gas, and just miserable. I was a horrible, horrible granddaughter, and my drinking just kept me going, and I didn't like what I was doing, but it was her fault. She shouldn't have gave me her car. She shouldn't have loaned me the money. She knows who I am. And, you know, and that was me. That was my hate. I'm a taker. I take, and I never gave back, and I never did anything for her. You know, never. And so now I'm having to take a look at this. I'm having to deal with this. I'm looking at me now in my recovery. And one of the first things that my second sponsor asked me to do was go mow your grandma's lawn. You're going to mow your grandma's lawn, and you're not going to accept a penny for it. You're going to do it, and you're not going to, even if she offers it to you, you're not going to do it. You're not going to take lunch from her. You're not going to ask for anything, and you no longer wash your clothes at her house. You're not going to do it. And if she wants to go somewhere, you're going to take her. And so I did. I was taking my grandma. I mean, I remember she'd show up at my, it got so normal or common for my grandmother, and I think she really liked it, because she'd show up at my house and it'd be 8 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday, and I want to sleep in, and she wants to go to some shopping center or something, you know, and I couldn't tell her no, because I was told I couldn't, and so I didn't do it, and I was doing all these things. I mean, my grandma's yard, it was spot on. It was spectacular. It was nice. Her flowers, her lawn, all the rocks that turned up. I mean, I it was getting detailed. I was getting good at what I was doing. I become a really good lawnmower, you know. And, I'll back up a little bit. When I was in the bars drinking, I remember begging and borrowing my grandma's car. I begged and begged again for it. And you know what I did? I went and sold it in the bar. I sold my grandma's car in the bar. And I remember crying, how am I going to make amends to these types of things, you know? And I remember I'd get mad at my family. I'd get mad at my other cousins, my nieces or my first cousins, who were still washing their clothes at my grandma's, you know, who were still borrowing her car, who were still eating her food. I was mad. And I remember my sponsor said, well, you're mad because you're not getting away with it no more. You're not getting anything. You're giving, you know? And that was it. I was giving. And I couldn't stay mad at my cousins. You know, she said, you can't fight them. Your grandma's doing for them what she used to do for you. You know, and so I just kept doing what I was doing. I just kept doing it. Well, one time my cousin had borrowed my grandmother's car, and it broke down and it wasn't fixable. And I remember I called my sponsor and I was crying. I said, they broke her car. I wanted to beat them up. She says, no, you can't do that. And I said, well, what am I going to do? She says, buy her one. You owe her one. You know? And that's exactly what I got to do. You know, and I'm not making a lot of money. I'm making minimum wage at the time, and I had to go back to work. I had to take on my old job that I stole and I thieved at and I lied at, and I'd done a lot of damage there. But I went back and I did not take a dime. I did an honest hour's work. I got an honest hour's pay. Nobody had to fire me. Nobody had to send me home at 6 o'clock in the morning because I showed up at 6 in the morning when my shift's at 6 in the evening, but I'm too drunk to know. You know, I was starting to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm doing everything that I'm supposed to be doing, and I didn't do it all right. I was still fighting. There was still a lot of stuff I was fighting, and I was always calling my sponsor, though, and now I'm telling on myself, and it was, you know, I'm thinking, God, I thought I was weak at one point, and I'm thinking, why do I do this? Why am I saying anything? But I really didn't have a choice. People, when they talked about that I had to do this, that I couldn't drink no more, that if I didn't do this, that I wouldn't never find the freedom, you know, and I wanted freedom. I wanted a peace of mind. There was a guy named Bernie, and I'd watch Bernie because Bernie just seemed like he had a peace of mind, and I've never had a peace of mind. I mean, I go to bed at night fighting. I don't get a good night's rest. I'm constantly just hating on people and, just so negative about everything that they do. And they don't even live with me. You know, they didn't. They weren't even part of my family. And even my family, though, I had to stop doing that. Even my family, I had to stop acting like or being control, you know, being in control over all them. And, you know, and so back to my grandmother, though, I was doing all these things. And I did them for probably 4 years because it was my fifth year sober. And I was sitting on my grandma's bed, and I'm playing with my medallion. I had just gotten out of the meeting, and I was playing with my five-year medallion on her bed. And my grandmother was cleansly. She was just a sweet lady. Her house was always nice and neat, you know. It actually was staying that way, too. So she picks up my medallion, and she says, "What is this?" And I said, "It's my medallion, Grandma. It means I'm 5 years sober." And she looked at me and she says, "Really?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm 5 years sober." And she cupped it and she says, "I think I'll keep this." And right there and then I knew my amends was made. I knew because I was now doing those things. Like, it was a treat for Grandma to come over and ask me to do something for her or take her somewhere. I was no longer, you know, like, I need to sleep in or I can't, you know. I mean, I was still taking her places, but I was still feeling that, you know, negativity that I didn't want to do, but I was told I had to. And I formed a really good, loving, caring relationship with this grandmother. And so I knew that was part of my amends, you know, and my mother, I got the chance to talk to her about her mother, not because it was my time, it was God's time. I was told I could not bring all this stuff up to my mom. I couldn't bring this stuff up about her mom if it was going to hurt her just to fix me. And it was something that I had to wait for, you know. And and my sponsor told me if she ever asks or brings it up, then you can. And my mom asked and brought it up, and we got down to business, and I learned a lot that day. I had asked my mom, because she wanted to know why it was that I didn't go pick up my grandmother. How come I never take her anywhere? How come I don't do those things? And I said, "Mom, I've tried." She didn't know I was trying. In my early recovery, I was trying. And I mean, I was still fairly early. It was 5 years. But I told her, "Mom, I tried." I said, she doesn't acknowledge me. She wants nothing to do with me, Mom. And I was able to ask her if she knew about the abuse, and she said yes. And I said, "Then why?" You know. And what she had told me was she was afraid of her too. And she said, "We send you to your grandma's because we figured that was safe for you." So it was her way of protecting me as a mother. And she's, you know, and it was, talk about knocking off the pain. Pain fell off of me like you wouldn't believe that day. I was relieved. I was no longer in the dark about my grandmother's abuse. And my mom knew and I understood why and I forgave her. You know, my grandmother, I love my grandmother. My grandmother, who was abusive, was getting really sick. And I treated her with the utmost respect. I'd do whatever my mom would tell me to do. I'd do whatever was asked of me as a family because I wanted to be of service to my family. And I wanted to be there for my uncles, my aunts, my other cousins, you know. And when my grandmother got really sick, she had been sick for a few years. And she had diabetes really bad. And so I go up and I'm still visiting her with all the other family and I'm around and I'm doing things with her and the family. When she got down to her last few weeks of this life, they put her on hospice and I got to be there in her home and help move her, help feed her, help keep her going, you know, keep her mouth moist, change her diaper, do all these things, keep turning her so she didn't get sores and whatnot. And I'm doing these things for my grandmother and she's, you know, she's not responsive to anything, but I'm doing all these things and I'm combing her hair and I'm doing. And this had went on for probably 2 to 3 weeks. and we're singing to her in our language and praying over her and whatnot. And I'm a part of my family, and I'm doing this with them because it is still my grandmother, and I still love my family. And I'm going to tell you the miracles of this program is just amazing to me, because the day my grandmother died, my cousin had come out of the room. He was singing in there with her, and he comes out and he says, "Grandma's gone, guys." And I felt a pain that came over me, and right after that pain came was the love that I can tell you that was just as great as the love that I had for the grandmother who had taken care of me. I've never felt that before, and that has never left me since. If I work this program and I do what I'm supposed to be doing and I do it right, I don't even really have to do it right. As long as I'm doing it, and God knows I have the heart to do it, the miracles were going to come. And that was a miracle for me. My mom knows this story today, and I got to share that with her. You know, how beautiful is that, that I can relieve my mom's pain? How beautiful is that, that I can love my grandmother today? You know, it's just a great, great thing that just continues to happen. My dad's brothers who had killed one another. That day I didn't lose just two uncles. I lost my dad in a big sense. And I lost my other uncle who was still alive. He lost it. He never really fully recovered from that. And he was in a lot of turmoil and a lot of pain. And I never knew what had happened. I was 13 years old and I never knew what had and why. And my uncle, he would call. He would call my grandmother's house and I'd be there. And he's in prison. And he'd call and he'd ask me how my dad was doing. Has your dad went hunting? Does he go fishing? How do you, you know, where did he go cut wood last? You know, and I'm telling him, I'm keeping him up with my dad, what my dad's been doing. Because my dad was good with all his brothers. He loved every one of them. And he was always hunting and fishing with one of them. And, so I'm keeping my uncle clued up on all the stuff that's going on in the family. And he keeps asking me, do you take care of grandma? Are you, you know, I'm kind of lying there because I'm taking advantage of her. But, you know, I'm keeping him up on everything. And now I'm sober and he's still calling, you know, and I'm still getting to talk to him, and I'm sober and I'm doing things, and I'm no longer telling him things that aren't real. You know, I'm telling him how things really are. And one day my dad shows up, and while my dad walks up and walks into the front door, I'm on the phone with my uncle, and he says, tell me what your dad's been doing. And I freeze and I can't say anything because my dad's standing right there. And he says, your dad's there, huh? And I said, yeah, he's right here. No, I don't even say that. I say, uh-huh. And he says, why don't you ask him if he'll talk to me? So I said, Dad, it's Uncle Clute. He wants to know if he'll talk to you, if you'll talk to him. And he says, my dad kind of takes his hat off and scratches his head and shakes his head a little bit and nods yes. And I handed him the phone and I walked out, and I'm standing outside on the balcony, and about 20 minutes go by and my dad comes back out and he says, let's go for a ride. So we went for this ride, and I'm going to tell you, my dad told me a story that I never knew. And he told me about the hate of two of his brothers and an anger that had festered because the brother that killed his real brother, they were half brothers, different fathers. And my uncle who had gotten killed was very mean to my uncle growing up because he wasn't a real brother. And he'd tell him, you're not a real baga. That's not even you. You're, you know, and just belittle him, and had beaten him up several times, even had put him into the hospital. These are things I didn't know. And I asked my dad, I said, are you okay, Dad? He says, yes, I forgive my brother. Again, I love Alcoholics Anonymous because God has allowed and revealed things to me that I held on to that were just painful things that were family guilt, family shame, things that, you know, I could never talk about. And today I don't have those family guilts, those family shames, you know. When I was talking about thinking I was a little boy when I was growing up and in kindergarten, when it came that I wasn't a little boy, I'm a little girl. They told me I had to use the little girl's bathroom, and they, you know, because they're teaching you how to wipe and whatnot. And I was devastated. I was devastated that I'm not going to be a little boy. You know, and I never told anybody that. I didn't tell anybody until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Because what happened was, I'm dating guys And it's just bizarre. I mean, I'm attracted. There's some attraction there, but it never went any. As soon as you say yes, I'm like, oh, God, you know? And so, you know, it was just growing up was just really painful. And today it's not painful at all. You know, I get to love that 5-year-old who wasn't a boy. I get to love that 6-year-old. When I was hearing you people tell me that I needed to take that 6-year-old and hold her, you know, love her. Today I see the beauty of my eyes. Sometimes I catch it and I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool. I do like the color of my eyes. You know, I'm not ugly. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous has did for me. It's not just not drinking. If it was just not drinking, I'd be dead. My soul would be dead and I wouldn't be who I am today. You know, and today I live a great life. I know who I am today and I'm not ashamed of who I am today. You know, and I'm sober. I've been sober 29 years now. I've never had to take another drink, and all I have to do is keep doing what I'm doing, and I keep, you know, helping family, I keep helping friends, I keep going to meetings, I keep calling my sponsor, you know, I keep calling her, I let her know what's going on, and if I can't get a hold of her, I get a hold of somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I let them know. Because this is a serious, serious disease, and it'll kill you. It's been killing us way before this, before we're so lucky to have Alcoholics Anonymous, because this disease was killing us. You end up in a sane asylum and there was never a solution for our problems, you know. And today it's just, I just have a great time. I really do. I enjoy Alcoholics Anonymous. I enjoy getting to do what I get to do today. I don't ride horses anymore. I got rid of my last 4 horses last year. I enjoy riding motorcycles now. There's more horsepower. And that's another thing is I'm not afraid to ride alone. I'll go to any state if I'm up to riding and if just get on and go. You know, it's my mom gets worried about me, and she should. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that it's the safest thing to do, but it's what I like doing. And I just picked up golf like last year and I can't stop playing it, you know. I even went out and got a coach, you know, the trainer, and it's, I'm just having a good time, and I'm running into old family members, I'm running into old friends. It's just awesome. It's just so awesome to be here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's so awesome to be with you people here today, and you know, there's just so much of my recovery that I don't get to cover with you, but trust me, if I didn't do it, I would have drank. I know today that I have to continue. I'm not a lying, cheating thief today. I've learned how not to steal. I've learned how not to take what's not mine. It's just, and that was tough. That was tough because I want your wallet. You know, I want your car. I'm going to sell whatever you have if I can get close to it. I don't do those things anymore. You know, I was also looking at 6 years of prison when I got here. I got pulled over one day and took me into jail, and they said you had felonies, outstanding warrants for your arrest for fraud, for embezzling and whatnot. And this wasn't the company that we have on the reservation. It was through friends, people who gambled. I was stealing from them, you know, and I got to make my amends to them. 2 of them accepted it and the other one didn't. And I know I made my amends because I never want to do those things again. I don't want that to be my character, you know. I didn't have to go to prison. I got out of that, you know, and I truly believe because I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. But I was prepared to go. My sponsor had told me if I went to prison, it was because God willing. I had to go clean up my wreckage of my past, and that after, I didn't have to take a drink if I went, and I'd still have recovery. God bless this program. God bless you people, and thank you for allowing me to be here today.